So good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary order. Thank you very much for being here. Today, I don't think we have any work session for introduction of the committee.
Yes, we do.
We do?
We have one.
Didn't look at my blue sheet. So we're going to go ahead and open up a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC be introduced as a committee measure, LC 3076, dated January 2nd, 2015.
All right. Senator Cruz moves LC 3076, dated January 2nd, 2015. And as we have normally do, let me go ahead and give our qualifying statement. A vote in favor for introducing the legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of the member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept. And I will add, and it doesn't even mean that it's actually going to, one, come to our committee, or two, actually get a hearing.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just briefly, can just for people who are listening and might not want to have to go look up 3076, can we have a little brief statement of, you know, maybe a little blurb up top?
Sure. It is. That works fine. There we go.
So this is my first time looking at it. LC 3076. It provides that insurer may not offer or issue policy, contract, or certificate of insurance that provides that insurer has sole right or right that is superior to right of insured to interpret terms and conditions of policy, contract, or certificate, or that specifies standard of interpretation or review that is inconsistent with the laws of this state. It requires policy, contract, or certificate of insurance to state that policy, contract, or certificate conforms to insurance code, that insurance code is incorporated into policy, contract, or certificate, and that insurance code controls over conflicting provision of policy, contract, or certificate. It requires policy, contract, or certificate of insurance to state that insured does not have sole right or right that is superior to right of insured to interpret policy, contract, or certificate, and may not specify standard for interpretation or review that conflicts with laws of this state. It applies required provisions to healthcare service contractors and trusts that carry out multiple employer welfare arrangement. It directs courts, arbitrator, or other adjudicatory authority to give full effect to required provisions and to construe provisions liberally to affect purposes of insurance code. This would become operative 91 days after the effective date of the act. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
That's clear as mud.
I'm pretty sure that helped everyone.
It'd be clearer to read the bill.
So, yeah, let me
appreciate
just say
it,
that
it gives us an idea.
Used a few words in there that are kind of highly charged liberally. To affect purposes of the insurance code. For those who are interested in the listening audience, both here as well as on the internet, you can go to the OLIS system, which is the Oregon Legislative Information System. It is already posted there. Again, this is LC 376. And for those who are listening, this will go to the Secretary of Senate's office to be assigned an actual bill, but you can still cross-reference it as LC 3076. All right, with that, any other discussion or comments? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. We'll go ahead and close the the work session for introduction of committee measures. We'll open up our informational meeting on the Oregon Youth Authority, and we have a number of individuals I think are going to be coming forward. So
good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fairbor Spaksuresh, Director of Oregon Youth Authority. We are here to present a fairly quick 15-minute overview of the agency. And, you know, I will do my best and I will stay within that time frame. What I tried to do in this presentation is to balance information about the structure of the agency and some facts about, you know, the youth that we deal with, combined with some of the major initiatives that we're moving. And my understanding is that you will be touring one of our facilities on March 3rd. At least that's March 2nd. Mm-hmm. Christine's here to correct me. So you want to introduce yourself?
She's our lifeline.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Christine Kirk, and I am the governmental affairs manager for the Oregon Youth Authority.
Yes. And, you know, I will be moving fairly quickly through this presentation, but, of course, you know, we'll stop at any point to answer questions. We'll start with the mission of the Oregon Youth Authority, which has not changed since the inception of the organization, which is to protect the public and reduce crime by holding youth offenders accountable, naturally providing safe environment for treatment and reformation. The vision of Oregon Youth Authority is those youth who we serve return to the community as crime-free and productive members of their communities. And our core values were developed with the help of our staff, and they're listed on the slide. And again, some of these slides, you know, we put in here for your reference, so I will not spend a whole lot of time on them. We are a public safety agency focused and committed to education and reformation. Nearly 1,000 employees with 10 close custody facilities, 25 field offices, and you can see our general fund budget and our total fund budget for this current biennium. And currently, we are serving 1,524 youth. The next slide is just an operational structure of OYA. Again, I'm not going to go through this slide. It's there for your information, and, you know, be glad. And I do understand that there is an electronic copy of this presentation available, right? Thank you. Slide number 5 shows where the youth come from, which counties. And when you look at those numbers, they're pretty much aligned with the population centers. You know, generally the I-5 corridor, that's where the youth are coming from. Very few from Eastern Oregon, few more from Central Oregon, and of course then you can see the numbers along the coastline. Slide number 6 shows the location of our close custody facilities with those red stars and then the 25 parole and probation offices across Oregon. We have 32 residential providers who we contract with to help our youth transition back to the community, and also the probation youth with the help of preventing them from coming into the deep end of the system. We have 115 Proctor and foster homes across Oregon that are managed by about 40 different agencies, and they provide pretty crucial services to us.
Could you just explain what if there is a difference between foster and Proctor?
Yes. Proctor homes are generally managed through contractors, like an agency that could have 5 or 6 different homes. Okay. Treatment could be provided, you know, in the home or outside the home. Both sets of parents have to be trained and certified. We deal directly with the foster parents, but with the Proctor parents, through agencies.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Slide number 9 shows the map of the Oregon juvenile justice system, and really just the highlight of this slide is the two tracks which youth come to us, one through the juvenile court and the other one through the adult court. When you look at the number of the youth in Oregon between the ages of 10 and 17, and these numbers are from 2013, you can see that out of nearly 390,000 youth, in 2013, a very small subset of those end up in the formal supervision of the counties, about 2,807, and even a smaller subset end up in our care and custody. This slide basically breaks down those 1,524 youth in OYA and shows the number who are under community supervision and the numbers that are in close custody. And then, of course, you know, there's also a breakdown of the close custody population. Of those 639 youth, 305 are coming to us through the adult court and 334 through the juvenile court. And then slide 12 further breaks down the DOC population. And you can see the different categories of commitment, Measure 11, waived, and then reduced mandatory. And, you know, when we talk about the apprenticeship bill that follows, this is the population that will be highly impacted by that apprenticeship bill. And we'll talk about that in more detail. This is the type of crimes that brings youth to us, and you can see the most on the top of the chart, we have sex offenses and property offenses. And then you can see the breakdown of the rest. This is a pretty important slide because it highlights the social characteristics of the youth that come to us. Pretty sobering stats here. 89% females and 70% of the male population comes to us with diagnosed mental health disorders. 45% of the females and 14% of the males have been sexually abused. You can look at the use of drug and alcohol. You can use of the parental use of drug and alcohol. You can see that nearly 10% of the girls and 12% of the boys are already the biological parent of a child. The message, one of the messages in this slide is many of these youth have been victims, and in the process they've created their own victims. So our task, one of the most important tasks for us in this organization, is to help treat these youth so that they don't create further victims, but at the same time, the concept of trauma-informed care is primary so that the trauma that they have been through can be addressed, and it is not further exacerbated by our interactions with them. This is a comparison of our population with the same group of age group of Oregon population. And you can see that we have very few 12 and 13-year-olds, relatively few 14 and 15-year-olds. The primary population that we serve are between the ages of 16 and 20. And then you can see that there is a major difference between the breakdown of female and male population, again, in the same group in Oregon and between the population in Oregon and the ones that we serve. Very few females compared to the male population that's coming to us. This slide shows the challenge that we have with overrepresentation of minority youth. Again, the breakdown of the Oregon population in those ethnic and racial groupings, and then our population. And what you can see is that we have overrepresentation of the African American youth, Native American youth, and Hispanic youth, and an underrepresentation of Caucasian and Asian youth.
I think this is very important here. I'm going to ask you to actually put onto the record, because people who are hearing this aren't actually knowing what you're referring to. We can see the slide. We had this with the Department of Corrections where they actually said, such as for African American, if I'm reading this correctly without my long vision glasses, 3% makes up Oregon, but 9%, so threefold.
Right.
So if you could do that for those, I just think that needs to be on the record. And the one that we did before that had on the percentage of women on the gender was also, I thought, pretty significant. And if you could tell us whether or not you're seeing in the forecast changes in the sense of DOC saying, is telling us that there's more women coming into the system than has historically been there.
We are not seeing that as far as the female population goes. And, you know, I am not proud to say that we have not been able to make major movements as far as this slide is concerned. You know, naturally, you know, there's a continuum that is engaged in how the youth come into our system, but we have not seen a reduction in the makeup of the ethnic population and the overrepresentation problem that we have. If you break this thing down further, so when you look at the African-American population right now, 9%, if you break that down further into close custody population and the residential population, actually the problem gets worse. It's about 12% that are actually locked up. So, yes, I mean, we can spend a lot of time on this, but...
I think we've noted it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
May I ask a question?
You may.
So has there been any comparison of that data to the out-of-school suspension data for kids? It looks very similar to the slides we've seen from the Department of Education around even starting with very young kids under the age of 12.
Senator Gelser, that's a great question. One of the studies that we're doing is what we call the feeder system study, meaning we are looking at data from Department of Education, child welfare, self-sufficiency, and some other areas that kids have contact with before they come to us. I don't have the answer to that question, but we will have that, you know, within the next probably 12 months. What we're trying to do is try to identify early signs of kids coming into our system and providing resources so that we can divert that population from ending up. But my hypothesis is that there's a direct correlation between those two numbers. I don't have any proof right now. We'll have that for you hopefully shortly.
Thank you.
Sure. So what are the opportunities that we have? We have a huge opportunity to capitalize on the juvenile justice information system, which is really one-of-a-kind information system in the nation that connects all 36 counties to the state organization, OYA, and allows us to do the kind of research and analytics that we apply to make better decisions. We have created a series of tools in Oregon, which are pretty unique and are being adopted by other states. We are trying to incorporate that into what we call the youth reformation system. I'll talk about that in just a moment. Naturally, conceptualizing and implementing that system is a huge opportunity. Another opportunity is working collaboratively with local and national partners. And, you know, I am pleased to say that we have improved our relationship with our local partners, and we are working together, you know, with the same focus. And that last bullet, avoiding the pendulum effect, really refers to the swinging pendulum of various perspectives around treating youth at the national level. One end of that pendulum is punishment. The other end is treatment. And, you know, the best that we can do is use the opportunity that we have to avoid that effect, because neither one of those extreme part of the continuum is the best option for youth. So to do that, we begin, and, you know, just very briefly, there are various perspectives about how to deal with juvenile offenders, and we've learned a whole lot within the past 10 or 15 years about brain development, about trauma-informed care, about accountability and everything else. So rather than be focused on a philosophy, we want to be focused on data and science and professional discretion. And in that, with that intent, we ask a series of very pointed questions. And you can see the questions on this slide. You know, what should be the capacity of our system? Are we bringing the right youth into the system, and are we placing them in the right environment? What should be the length of stay in each part of the continuum? What interventions are needed to maximize the success of youth? And frankly, these are questions that all of my counterparts across the nation want to know the answers to. How do we hire and support the workforce that's effective in dealing the youth that we serve? We know that youth are extremely impressionable, and who comes in contact with them can affect how their development process goes and, you know, their future success. How do we create the environments where youth are viewed as assets and can be developed? And how do we support the integration of youth back into their communities? That's a major point of failure. When youth come from environments and then go back to those same environments, how can we support them to succeed? And last but not least, how do we know that the interventions and the money that we're spending is actually paying back? To answer these questions, we developed a system which we call the Youth Reformation System, also referred as the YRS. This system actually includes various components. It's a system which I will explain in just a few moments, again, very briefly because of the time that we have. But it includes an approach toward a particular culture. It includes a series of tools and practices, and it includes a measurement, a continuum of looking at what we're doing and measuring whether or not we're being effective. So what is the Youth Reformation System? And, you know, if you go to any county juvenile department today, they know what the YRS is because we're working together on this thing. It's a system that uses data, research, and predictive analytics to inform decision-making and support professional discretion. And that's a pretty important phrase, professional discretion, because data and numbers don't make decisions for youth. Individuals do. Professionals do. And this system is simply providing that data to help that decision-making. What this system can do for us is reduce further and future victimization and maximize the use of resources. The system has four components, and these four components are directly intended to answer some of those questions. Are the right, what should the capacity of the system be today and the future? Is through that component of population forecast. Are we placing the youth in the right environment with the right treatment? Do we know that our programs are being effective? And how do we work with the community? That feeder system study that I just referred to earlier is part of that community context. The other piece is transition. Are we putting systems and processes and practices in place to help youth succeed when they go back to their communities? To implement this system, what we need is a new mindset and culture. And what we call positive human development, which emerged from the national practice of positive youth development, but our philosophy is that we as adults can also develop as we deal with our youth. And we do that through supportive relationships, through meaningful participation, and we encourage opportunities and support the growth of youth through increased engagement and facilitated learning. And as I talk about learning, education is a pretty important component of the work that we do, and probably the most important factor to reduce future crimes. And, you know, I can cite the studies in Texas and other places that really is pretty eye-opening as far as what the impact of education is. And, you know, education includes both K-12, college, and vocational education. And Christine will talk about that, you know, briefly when we talk about the bill. So what is this system, what is this positive human development built on? It's built on a foundation of safety and security. How am I doing on time?
A little bit over.
Am I over already? Okay, I'll hurry. So, you know, built on safety and security, on caring and supportive relationships. Accountability is the heart of the system, meaningful participation, and naturally community connection. And again, you know, we can talk about this in detail, but, you know, when you tour the facility, we'll actually show you examples of how this thing is implemented. We have some tools and practices that we have developed, pretty unique to Oregon, again, being adopted by other states. This is one example of that tool. It's called a typology that actually takes into consideration the risk factors, which are those red lines, and the strength factors, which are those green lines of a youth, and creates a specific treatment program for that youth. Just one thing, I just want to take one moment to that line that says a treatment approach. Says these youth tend to respond to punitive interventions with further escalation, reducing the likelihood of positive support with staff or desired skill development. So what we know about these youth if we strictly punish them, they are actually going to respond negatively. So we have to design a treatment plan that holds them accountable but deals with them in a positive manner. And, you know, there are 6 typologies for boys and 4 typologies for girls. And finally, how do we know that we're actually being successful? We in Oregon actually have put a system in place which we call the OYA Performance Management System, a framework. This is what is called the fundamentals map that identifies our core processes and sub-processes and measures and reports on every one of those things. More than 100 measures across OYA reported on a quarterly basis. We are having our 16th quarterly target review next week, which means we've been doing this for nearly 4 years. So I'm pretty much done because I'm over time, but just very quickly, challenges that we have in front of us is implementing these things. Changing cultures and mindsets is not an easy thing to do. You all know that. Balancing safety and security with a developmental approach. Aligning our physical structures to the emerging data about the most effective approach to deal with youth. And last but not least, modernizing JGIS. This is a system that allows us to do all this work, and it was built nearly 20 years ago, and we need to upgrade that system so that we can continue this work. So I'll stop there. And
wonderful. Thank you. Let me ask if there's any questions for the director. I have 2 that I just want to follow up on.
Sure.
On the YRS, that's the system that we've come up, and this is the one that's being, let's say, adopted by other states.
Yes.
Is there some type of, let's say, fee arrangement? Are we just providing this to them, or are we actually selling this as a product?
We are not, Chair Przanski, we are not selling it as a product. There's a lot of collaboration that happens at the national level. I'm actually part of what's called the CJCA, Council for Juvenile Correctional Administrators, which includes all 50 states, and some, Multnomah County is also a member. And we share a lot of practices and tools. And, you know, we benefit from what other states can offer to us, and we do the same thing. So it's a good exchange. And we actually did a webinar here just a few months ago for the state of Iowa, Texas, and Massachusetts on this youth reformation system. And they are implementing the various aspects of that. In return, we have monthly phone calls with the state of Missouri, which is the benchmark of dealing with youth and treating them in a safe and nonviolent environment. So they're helping us change our culture and move toward that.
Thanks. I just want to put that on the record. The last thing is I had the opportunity with three other legislators to be on a state prison tour of Angola, state prison in Louisiana. Yes. And based on what I'm seeing, that what we're doing is, I guess I'm calling it the positive behavior modification model, is what they've seemed to have moved to as well. And it's significant to see how they have been able to change a prison that has been known for decades as a very, say, bad place to be, into a situation that where you have a sense of a lot of safety, security, a lot of respect within the walls for the offenders as well as the staff. Staff's prohibited from having any type of contradictory type of verbalization. I mean, they cannot use curse words, et cetera, toward the offenders, and actually are seeing results that are pretty remarkable as to how that runs, to the point of where they even have female security officers in Angola working solo on the tiers in the evening. And it's just, you know, to me, it's pretty amazing how they have made such a significant change. There's multiple other reasons why they would say that, but it seems that we've got that same type of approach through this positive behavior modification.
Thank you, Senator Porzanski. I would hope that we're doing that, and I've heard actually about that tour and, you know, the results that they're achieving there, and we would love to hear your perspective when you tour our facility to see what we're doing that might be similar and any ideas that you might have that we could put in place.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you all very much. What I'm going to ask you to do is step back. What I'm going to do is go ahead and close the informational hearing. I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing and work session section and go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 334. Senator Johnson is here, has waited patiently, and I want to go ahead and let her get on with her other task that she has scheduled for today.
Thank you. Thank you for your courtesy, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I am the senator from District 16 that includes Columbia County. Senate Bill 334 provides that a person who falsely reports a hazardous substance, fire, explosion, catastrophe, or other emergency in a court facility commits the crime of disorderly conduct in the first degree. The fact scenario that gave rise to this bill occurred at the Columbia County Courthouse, and I have with me two people that are uniquely qualified to discuss the bill, among other things. Their offices are at the Columbia County Courthouse. County Commissioner Earl Fisher and District Attorney Steve Acheson.
All right, before we go started, we kind of jumped right into this, and I appreciate that, but I think I'm going to let counsel just give a quick overview of what the bill does, and then we'll take the testimony.
Okay, Chair Porzanski, members of the committee, this bill, Senate Bill 334, is sponsored by Senator Johnson. The bill amends the disorderly conduct statutes in the criminal code. The bill elevates conduct that is currently disorderly conduct in the second degree to disorderly conduct in the first degree if the focus of that conduct is a courthouse. Disorderly conduct in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor for the first offense and a Class C felony for each subsequent offense.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, whoever would like to go first, if you'll give us your name for the record, that'd be great.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Earl Fisher. I have the honor of being one of the commissioners from the Columbia County. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak for you today. In the period of about 5 months this past year, Columbia County Courthouse experienced 4 bomb threats, 5-1, 8-27, 10-6, and 10-7. Now, I appreciate when these people called these in that they made sure the weather was nice and we didn't have to stand out in the rain. But outside of that, it was a headache for us. We were able to catch two individuals who were responsible for the 10-6 and 10-7 calls. It was then that we discovered that the only offense covered a Class B misdemeanor. I have a history of working in the school systems as an administrator, and if you do that in the school system, you got a Class A misdemeanor. The bomb threat cost the county over $25,000 in terms of lost wages to people working and standing out in the street instead of in the courthouse. Cost the courts over $5,000. It also cost the public safety people who responded, and there were 9 to 10 folks that had to come in and clear the courthouse from the police agencies. So it's an expensive to the county. It does not include the cost to our private citizens who came down to the court to do their business, had to rearrange their day. If you're going to court, you had to take a day off of work. You have lawyers that you probably are going to have to pay. And we had to reschedule the docket, which is a headache in and of itself. It also created a great deal of anxiety among our employees, as you can imagine. So I requested to have this particular offense increased in terms of its punishment. These false reports cost the public citizens money. It disrupts the business of the county government, and it creates an anxiety and safety issue for all those involved. I'd like to thank Senator Johnson for assisting us in bringing this issue to your attention.
Steve?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I really don't have anything to add to the factual background.
But I need your name.
Steve Atchison, excuse me, the Columbia County District Attorney.
Thank you.
I was here to talk about the statutory language and how we worked on this. I remember when it happened, the police came to my office as these things were going on. What can we do? And I said, well, you can't do much. It's a B misdemeanor. By the way, it would be a B misdemeanor if you had to evacuate this building for a bomb threat also, and most other government buildings for that matter. I don't know how far that should reach, but it was quite significant at the courthouse. Anecdotally, on the last one of these, I believe, I was in my office and didn't hear the warning to evacuate because it comes over in the Columbia County system. It comes over your phone in your office. There's an intercom hooked into the phone system. And I was in another part of my office looking for some files and not near my phone. And I came wandering out on my way to lunch, and the fire marshal said, what were you doing in there? We've been evacuated for 45 minutes. And I said, well, I didn't hear that. And they said, oh, so I imagine there are certain members of the public who wouldn't mind if I was in the building when the bomb went off, but I wasn't one of them. So thank you.
All right, thank you. So first let me ask if there's any questions. Let me follow up, Steve, with a couple of things.
Yes, Chairman.
From what Mr. Fisher says, there are four instances, and if I got the dates right, not that it matters, but 10-6 and 10-7 found the actors. Have yes. they been prosecuted?
Yes, I believe they, Mr. Chair, they were prosecuted in St. Helens Municipal Court, not in my office, because it's a misdemeanor. We do have a municipal prosecutor. They took it that route. But my understanding is they were prosecuted in that court.
And do we know if they were involved in both instances, or were they two separate individuals, like a copycat and...
No, I believe it was a group of individuals responsible for all of them. My understanding was from talking to the police when they completed an investigation was one of the individuals had a court case pending and figured, well, if the courthouse is evacuated, I don't have to show up. And that's really how they thought. And I believe...
They're not necessarily the brightest individuals.
Not necessarily at all.
Any other questions, comments? So, Senator Johnson, you and I have not had a chance to talk, and I think Steve has brought up the point that this is a narrow this application and just adding, in this case, courthouses. Would you have any issues with us looking at maybe broadening this out broader to other type of public facilities or buildings?
Mr. Chair, other than appreciation, no.
All right. Thank you very much. So we are not going to be able to move the bill today, because even though if we were going to move it today, as it's written, we do not have the fiscal that's necessary to move the bill forward. But the testimony is greatly appreciated. What we'll do is we'll work on possible an amendment that would address this issue of broadening it out to other type of public buildings, and we'll look at the definitions and ensure that we capture what we think is appropriate if there's, let's say, appetite within the committee to move forward.
Mr. Chair, will your staff have the amendments drafted, or would you like me to do that?
We'll take care of that.
Given that there was a fire alarm yesterday, or an alarm, we didn't know what kind. Fortunately, it was a test. It seems that the adding other public buildings is particularly timely. Thank you.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you very much for being here. Let me just make certain there's no other questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question for them, but okay. I just want to kind of maybe put it out there for whoever might be wanting to testify or think about this bill. Maybe this is a question for you. Do you think the enhanced penalties would have prevented these reports? And where it is applied to schools, has it reduced the number of false reports? Maybe you don't know about that part, but has it reduced the number of false reports?
Let me give you the perspective based on how the current statute's written as it pertains to the schools. It has an enhanced penalty built into it. So let's say you get one bite of the apple as a Class A misdemeanor. Second time, you're now going into the C felony range. And so that would be, you know, enhancing the penalties. This would be, I would assume, a property crime as compared to a person crime, if I'm
Steve, I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair. I don't believe it's categorized. If you get up to the enhanced level, I don't believe it's a person crime.
Yeah, I think it'd still be wouldn't be a person crime. So there's an issue as to, you know, I guess how would that play out as to what the sanctions would be. I find that in many cases, a Class A misdemeanor, you can get more, let's say, skin from an individual than you can with a Class C felony, just because of how they are ranked on the sentencing guidelines. But Steve, would you like to?
Sure, I would agree with that. It would probably be a very low-ranked felony. I haven't looked at it, but my guess it would be a 1, 2, 3, 4, something like that. And the possibility of actual incarceration, if you will, is very low, as you know, for first-time C felons. And can get up to a year, as you know well, for an A misdemeanor.
Other follow-up?
I guess enhanced penalties wasn't the right term. I guess an escalation of sanctions, or, you know, moving it up. I guess that was my comment. But, yeah, just wondered if that helps prevent these things.
Mr. Chair, one would assume that they would be more reluctant to take the second bite of the apple, knowing what the matrix would look like for them. So,
and I would say if they're properly counseled and they listen to their counsel, that's probably true. But the reality, I think, I would say from my experience in the field, many people do not think about or anticipate what the penalty is or would be before they do what they do. And when you hear the reason why this person or persons were doing it, to somehow cover themselves to not have to appear in court. I mean, again, that's a pretty dim bulb that is making these decisions.
If I could just comment on that, my experience in school is that it's very similar. The test coming up, I don't want to take the test. Call it the bomb threat. If you can catch them and there is a price to be paid, it may not stop that individual from ever doing it the first time. But the guy sitting in the seat next to him knows that there is a penalty to be paid. And that is one of the things that I think is a deterrent down the road. It may not stop the first one, but I think it really helps stop the second. If you can catch him and you can publicize, in fact, there's something to be paid for doing something that's stupid. So that's been my experience in the school and just my staff. When they found out, the police responded, we're going to do what? Why waste my time? And that is a very negative impact, and I would like to see that removed. But
perhaps wraparound services for mental health would be good. These people.
Could be a start. All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 334? Gail, you're sitting in the back. I don't know if you wanted to actually. You had that look on your face, and I figured I should call you out there.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It was fascinating to listen to the conversation posed by Senator Thatcher's questions. We have no problem with this bill. What Senator Thatcher, what your question posed up was, is there a difference between punishing someone in separate custody cycles versus all in one batch? And let me explain that. There is a difference. When an offender offends, is caught and punished, and then goes out and repeats it again, that's a different kind of an offender than who did a series of events and is caught the first time. And as this bill is structured, it escalates it to it on that second conviction for that second custody cycle. That really is a different kind of an offender than one who makes multiple mistakes and then is nailed. So we don't have a problem with the bill as it's posed. We think the escalator does make sense because, quite frankly, it's a different kind of an offender who hasn't gotten the message the first time.
Okay, so, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming forward. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 334. As I stated, we'll be working on an amendment for this bill. And we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 240. Christine, if you'd please come back. And thank you very much for your courtesies to allow us to get Senator Johnson on her way.
Thank you for doing that.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 240 comes to us at the request of Governor Kitzhaber for the Oregon Youth Authority. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We have no amendments at this time. Under current Oregon law, the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council may make exceptions to the apprentice wage schedule, the journey worker hourly wage rate, and the minimum ratio of journey workers to apprentices, as it deems necessary or advisable to further the operations of apprenticeships and training programs in the Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 240 allows ASATC to treat apprenticeship programs through the Oregon Youth Authority in the same manner as it does apprenticeship programs through the Department of Corrections.
Chair Przanski, committee members, my name is Christine Kirk, and I am the Governmental Relations Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. Thank you very much for hearing from us today. After I say a few words, the other members of the Oregon Youth Authority to my left will introduce themselves. This bill just allows us to get a start. It doesn't approve a program within the Oregon Youth Authority. It allows us to apply, and for when we do apply, that there is an exception that BOLI can consider, the Bureau of Labor and Industries can consider, that works within a correctional facility. As was noted, this exists for the Department of Corrections, and previously, as the director stated, half of our youth that are in our custody actually are there as Department of Corrections youth. They have rather long lengths of stay, some of which do then go to the Department of Corrections, others are released into the community. So an apprenticeship is a good tool with those youth because of their length of stay, or young adults because of their length of stay. They're with us long enough for us to be able to get this sort of training and work towards. We currently do have educational vocational programs, and so this is a nice fit within what we're already doing, but it allows better structure that we don't currently have. We may be able to provide a little bit of education, have youth follow work people who are doing the work around and learn, but we don't have the ability for that to translate into the community. So an apprenticeship and training program would allow for us to have the structured educational component as well as the hands-on component, and most importantly, it would allow those hours to be carried into the community. So when people leave, even if they didn't get a license or certificate, they would be able to officially say, look at what I did, and they would be able to apply that into a community setting should they pursue that within the community. What this allows us to do, too, is to, in terms of legitimizing what we're doing, is build our partnerships, because we don't work in a silo. And so when it comes to skills and job readiness, it is very important that we have those linkages within the community. So with the approval of this bill, we will be able to start to develop programs and work with the trades and employers and in the community and determine what are the best things that we can do to set our youth up for success, what are the opportunities that already exist, what are the partnerships that we can develop with the trades, and we are very excited about that. It allows us to further extend and build strength to the things that we already believe in, and so we're very appreciative of the opportunity. But this is just the beginning of the relay race. It doesn't say that we've got the program at the end. And with that, I would like to introduce the folks who do the work and are much more familiar with our training programs. First will be Rex Emery, who manages our facilities.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. As Christine said, my name is Rex Emery, and I'm the facilities manager for the Oregon Youth Authority.
Rex, could you take the microphone and pull it down a little bit? Just I want to make sure you get recorded and covered. Thank you.
Is that better?
That'd be great. Okay.
Scooch the chair up. Physical plant operations, one of our sections is the maintenance departments. And I'm going to speak just very briefly about the work experience program, the program where staff, professional trade staff, work individually with youth doing the day-to-day maintenance operations. But before I do that, Matt Brandt is our supervising electrician. He's our expert when it comes to all things electrical and related to the apprenticeship trades. And he's joining as a moral support and to answer any questions that I can't. So as I said, I want to just give you a brief overview of the work experience program and how we use it within our facilities. The OAA physical plant operations section is responsible for the care and maintenance of 10 correctional facilities, 762,000 square feet of space. We have 26 of 33 employees that work in that section work with youth on a wide variety of different trade skills. The work they do with youth is teaching the vocational skills that helps us in the routine maintenance of our facilities. These young men and women learn trade skills, and most importantly, they learn how to work. Most of the youth that come to our system don't have the built-in work ethic or knowledge for how to hold a job or how to perform on a job. The tradespeople, that's one of the first things that they teach them. They'll essentially teach them the fundamentals of being a successful employee. Currently, professional trade staff are required to supervise a minimum of 2 youth for safety and security purposes. Senate Bill 240 will allow youth to participate in the apprenticeship while keeping our safety and security protocols in place. Currently, the rule only allows for one-on-one supervision, which we can't do in our facilities safely. We never allow staff or youth to go off one-on-one with each other. To qualify for the program, youth must be successful in treatment programs. They have to have graduated school or have a GED and been successful in their living unit communities. For us, this is the accountability piece. Young men and women who leave our facilities with vocational skills and especially trade licenses and have confidence, the confidence that comes from knowing how to work, are much more likely to successfully transition into Oregon's communities and go on to lead crime-free lives. Additionally, this will help meet the governor's 40-40-20 plan, the plan that asks for 40% of all adults who have earned an associate degree or some sort of post-secondary credential. The licensing would meet that credential. And really, that's it. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? I have one. If you could go back over this, the one-to-one as to what the protocol is. I heard it, but I don't know if I heard everything. I want to make sure I got that correct as to the requirement or the protocol that the youth authority uses on one-to-one ratios.
You bet. So when the trades departments first started bringing youth in to work with them, I mean, we saw this tremendous opportunity for kids to learn job skills and to learn specific trade skills. You know, just as an interesting aside, you know, the youth who are in our system often are very comfortable doing things out in the communities that would be terrifying for most of us. Running a skill saw, operating a tractor, swinging a hammer, those are the things that scare them. our tradespeople take a little bit of time and teach them how to use those tools, teach them those trades, and we see a transformation. Their confidence levels go up, and they actually get to the point where they know that they can hold a job. The one-to-one challenge for us is the tradespeople are in all of the nooks and crannies of the institutions. So it's very possible for an electrician to be working on a light fixture down a dark hall by themselves. And it would be completely inappropriate and risky for that electrician and for the youth to be in a one-on-one situation. So our protocol for safety and security is that it's one staff with at least two youth, three is even better.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I wanted that on the record. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to give? Oh, it's Daryl. I saw your, I'm sorry. Daryl Fuller. And when Daryl's coming up, does anyone else want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 240?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, welcome back to Salem. And congratulations to Senator Thatcher and Senator Gelzer on moving up from the kids' table. My name is Daryl Fuller. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors, supporting Senate Bill 240. I don't want to take belabor an issue that I think will generally have support. I just want to point out a couple of things real quickly. One is we know that one of the greatest factors in reducing recidivism is a good job. Not necessarily a job, but a good job, a good-paying job, and the trades provide those. The other thing I would point out is that in some of the trades, particularly plumbing, one of the clients that I represent, the age of a journeyman plumber in Oregon is over 50 years old. We have a lot of positions that we need to fill, and it's difficult sometimes, especially in a good economy, to get people to interested in becoming a plumber. And in a bad economy, the journeyman programs don't have work to provide to people in journeyman programs or into apprenticeship programs. So providing opportunities for people that are looking for a skilled trade in the Department of Correction or the Oregon Youth Authority is probably a pretty good idea. The other thing that I will mention is that the Oregon Youth Authority can house inmates up until their 25th birthday. And so we're not talking about kids that are necessarily just out of high school looking for something to do. We're looking for kids that have maybe been there for 3 or 4 years outside of high school, and for them to be able to participate in an apprenticeship program that then would transition to the Department of Corrections or could transition to a traditional apprenticeship program when they're released makes all kinds of sense if they're going to be held at the Oregon Youth Authority as long as their 24th birthday. So we think this is a good idea. We appreciate the bill being brought forward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Daryl, thank you very much. Not seeing anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 240, we'll close the public hearing. This bill is not ready to move. At this point, we have ongoing discussions between the Oregon Youth Authority and some of the trades as to ensuring that everyone is on the same page or trying to be on the same page. We will, in fact, have this bill rescheduled. I am started some discussions with some of the trade groups to express my desire to see the bill move forward, that I think this is an extremely positive perspective and what we should in fact be using to move youth that have troubles and have had issues into the opportunity to actually come out with a job skill that's going to allow them to actually provide for themselves and others.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest in that communication you say that you're not alone in that desire. I would suggest it's the committee's desire as well.
Right. So I appreciate that. Any other comments? Thank you very much. So I think I did close it, but if I didn't, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 240. And I believe that takes care of our business for today. I'm looking at everyone to make certain before I gavel out. So we will be back since we do not have scheduled Friday meetings at this time. We'll be back this next Monday. Start time is 8:30. And thank you very much, and everyone have a good day and a good weekend. And a good weekend.